From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, satirist Al Franken tells us about his 8-day USO tour, performing for the troops in Iraq, Afghanistan, Uzbekistan, and Kuwait, and he'll do some of the material from the show. He returned home on Christmas Eve. This was his 4th USO tour in 5 years. Also, we talk with actor Benicio del Toro. His performance as a Mexican cop in the film Traffic won him an Oscar for Best Supporting Actor. He's now starring in the film 21 Grams. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The senior U.S. military commander in Iraq, Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez, told NPR today that attacks on American troops are down significantly since the capture of Saddam Hussein. NPR's Eric Westervelt reports from the Pentagon.
Speaking by phone from Iraq, Lieutenant General Sanchez told NPR's All Things Considered that in the last 3 weeks, the number of attacks on U.S. soldiers is down.
The daily engagements that we have had across the entire country have dropped from a daily average of about 40 or so in the late November timeframe to a point today where we're experiencing less than 20 on any given day.
Still, Sanchez said 20 attacks is 20 too many, and attacks on aid agencies and Iraqi civilians continue. 2 French civilians today working for an American contractor were shot and killed after their car broke down outside of Fallujah. Eric Westervelt, NPR News, the Pentagon.
6 Democratic candidates for president criticized administration foreign policy during a radio debate today in Des Moines, Iowa. Former Vermont Governor Howard Dean said the Bush administration's timetable for turning over sovereignty in Iraq is driven by domestic political considerations.
I think first elections, then handover, and I think the timetable for July 1st, the idea they're going to have a constitution ready by July 1st is an idea that I think is unlikely and mostly driven by Karl Rove's political advice, which I don't think is particularly good in foreign policy.
The debate was sponsored by NPR and member station WOI. NASA's Spirit rover has sent back the most detailed color picture ever taken of the Martian landscape. Scientists say that in one spot, the surface looks truly alien. NPR's David Kestenbaum reports.
In the picture, the ground next to the lander seems to buckle and fold like clay. This is the spot where the airbags retracted, pushing the dirt around. Steve Squires leads the scientific team.
The way in which this surface has responded to the dragging of airbags across this is bizarre. It's not like anything that I have ever seen before. It's very weird-looking stuff.
The Viking mission spotted similar material in the 1970s, but no one knows exactly what it is. Scientists plan to examine it in more detail. All the scientific instruments tested so far seem to have survived the landing. Team members plan to roll the rover out onto the Martian surface soon. They say they will direct its first movements. Eventually, Spirit will do some navigation for itself. David Kestenbaum, NPR News, Washington.
A panel of artists and architects in New York City has chosen a memorial design for the World Trade Center site. The plan calls for 2 reflecting ponds in a field paved with stone. It's to be called Reflecting Absence. In stocks today, the Dow lost 5 points to close at 10,538 in active trading. The Nasdaq was up 10 points to close at 2,057. This is NPR News. A federal appeals panel has upheld the congressional redistricting plan created by Republicans in Texas. The plan was approved by the GOP-dominated Texas legislature last October after months of political fighting that included 2 walkouts by Democratic members. Republicans say the new map represents Republican electoral gains in the state. Democrats say the newly created districts discriminate against minorities. An audit of nearly 200 dioceses says Catholic bishops are complying with new rules regarding sexual abuse of children. But victims' advocates say the audit was flawed. NPR's Barbara Bradley Haggerty reports.
According to the auditing firm, 90% of the 191 dioceses in the audit were following the new rules, doing things like setting up policies to respond to allegations or to remove abusive priests from ministry. Wilton Gregory, the head of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, was delighted.
We wanted to make sure that we put in place fundamentally sound policies to protect children and young people. We achieved that. We now want to build on that achievement.
But critics noted that the bishops hired the auditing firm and the bishops could not be compelled to hand over information. They also said that writing policies would not guarantee that priests or bishops would follow them. Barbara Bradley Haggerty, NPR News, Washington.
The Agriculture Department says DNA testing has confirmed that the first cow to develop mad cow disease in the United States was born in Canada. U.S. and Canadian labs both concluded that the cow in question was born on a dairy farm in Alberta. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Whole Foods Market, purveyor of natural beef from cattle raised without animal byproducts and monitored throughout the entire production process. More information at wholefoodsmarket.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is the satirist Al Franken. He spent 8 days in December on a USO tour, entertaining the troops in Iraq, Afghanistan, Kuwait, and Uzbekistan. He performed in Tikrit just a few days after Saddam Hussein was captured. Franken returned home to New York City on Christmas Eve. He was a longtime writer and cast member of Saturday Night Live. Franken's latest book is the bestseller Lies and the Lying Liars Who Tell Them, A Fair and Balanced Look at the Right. Al Franken, welcome back to Fresh Air. Some people be surprised that you do these USO tours because you don't support the war in Iraq and you don't support the Bush administration. So what would you say to the people who are surprised that you're doing it?
Well, it's not that I don't support the war in Iraq. I mean, we're there now, so I certainly support our troops that are there, and I certainly support the mission that we've been backed into, which is to make Iraq secure enough to become as Western style a democracy as it can be. I mean, that's what we have to do now. So it's not that I, you know, want us to leave. I've done 4 USO tours in the last 5 years, and I love doing them, and I love our troops. And the sort of the idea that patriotism is something that Republicans and conservatives can wrap themselves in and belongs only to them is something I reject. And also, by the way, it's a lot of fun, and it's very moving, and really feel like it's something I can do. I did not serve in the military. When I was of draft age, I was in college, and the government felt that it was better for me to complete my education to prepare me for my chosen profession, comedian, than to actually go to war in Vietnam.
So does the State Department have any reservations about taking you on USO tours since you're so outspoken against President Bush?
I don't know if they get wind of it, the State Department. I know the Pentagon did. And you see, the USO is kind of separate from the Pentagon, and they know me there. And as I said, I've done 3 of these before, including while Bush was president, as we were starting Operation Enduring Freedom in Afghanistan, which I did support. And they know me. I mean, I don't do Daryl Worley, who is a terrific country singer who had a very big hit with Have You Forgotten, which is a sort of fairly jingoistic song about the war, justifying our war in Afghanistan, which I don't know who disagreed with that, knew I, when he heard I was coming, he was kind of peeved, and he told me this toward the end of the tour, and because he didn't want to have to debate Iraq with me, and because he's very pro the war there, and very sort of, and he is very jingoistic, and I said, Daryl, were you afraid that I would like, because I was co-MC, that I would introduce you as, you know, to the troops as, your president lied to you, and you are dying for no reason. Ladies and gentlemen, Daryl Worley, you know. And he laughed, and we actually just got, part of the experience of doing a USO tour, at least the ones I've done is I've been part of a sort of a traveling troupe of show folk. We feel like show folk going around. I remember we arrived at Kandahar and late because our plane took off from Baghdad late. And we got there fairly late, and Daryl and I were taken in a vehicle, and there was an officer there, and he said, "Now, I don't know if you guys want to do a show. You got here so late, but if you just want to do a meet and greet." And Daryl and I looked at each other like, and I said to him, like, "No, you don't understand. We're show folk. we're a traveling troupe of show folk. The only place we live is on the stage. You can't take that away from us. We're show folk." So part of the joy is doing the show. And I had a gas. I did, you know, I did a very kind of Bob Hope or Mighty Carson Art Players attack on the show. I did really dumb, stupid stuff, and there's a lot of sex and a lot of stuff about the military, and the USO knows that I do that. They know that I've done that in the last three tours, and they totally trusted me.
Well, what's your material like when you're doing? What was your material like for this latest USO tour?
Well, this was really fun. I brought Andy Breckman along. Andy Breckman is a colleague, a comedy writer. A colleague of mine who wrote on Letterman and wrote on Saturday Night Live and is the creator of Monk and the executive producer of that show. He's a very high-priced comedy writer who I brought. They had some good comedy writers. So what we did was, again, we approached this sort of like a Bob Hope show. So Andy wrote my first line was, what would happen is Carrie would come out, and Carrie Turner is an actress on JAG, a show that the guy that goes on Armed Forces Television and that the guys love. I've never seen it, but it's a very popular show on CBS in its ninth season, and Carrie is terrific, and she's a pretty blonde, and she would come out and say some very sincere thoughts of her own and then introduce me, and I'd come out, and my first line was, "So, anybody here from out of town?" And then my next line was, "Boy, this Army chow is not agreeing with me. You know, I've had five of these MREs." Those are meals ready to eat. "I've had five of these MREs, and none of them seem to have an exit strategy." And then I just do like, "But it's an honor to be here with Carrie. 9 seasons on JAG." And she goes, "Well, yeah." And I said, "Well, you must have had a lot of thousands of guest hosts or guest stars on the show." She said, "Well, yeah, we've been, not thousands, but we've had a lot. We've been very lucky." I said, "Well, I noticed that I haven't been a guest on JAG." And she said, "Well, you know, we've been very lucky." And I said, "Well, I hope maybe by the end of, now that we've done this together, that I could be a guest." And she said, "Well, you know, it's a drama. It's not a comedy." And I said, "Well, actually, that's why I've taken the liberty of writing an audition piece for JAG. And then it's just a piece in which I play a visiting prosecutor who's been sent to JAG Ops by the Pentagon to shake things up, Lieutenant Lance Hardgrove. And in it, and it's just stupid. I brought it so I could
read a
little bit of it.
Good.
She goes, I give her the script. I say, "It's your line." She goes, "Lieutenant Hardgrove, what are you doing here in JAG Ops?" "I told you, Harriet. Call me Lance." They laughed at that. "Lieutenant Hardgrove, this is JAG Ops. It's all business here." "Is it? Then why are you wearing that negligee?" And then they cheered that. She says, "Al, my character would never wear a negligee in the office. You would if you were madly in love with Lieutenant Lance Hardgrove." "Al, I'm married on the show to Lieutenant Bud Roberts. I have 2 kids." Yeah. Keep reading. And then she reads, "Lance, I've been wearing this. I'm wearing this negligee because I want to be tonight to be very special. I want to give myself to you completely. Now kiss me." Then I kiss Carrie. I just grabbed her and kissed her. And she fights me off. And she says, "Now wait a minute, Al. You just wrote this so you could kiss me." And now they're cheering, the guys. And she says, "If I could kiss anybody, it'd be a real soldier. Like one of these brave men." Now they're cheering. "Or women." "Who wants to help me out?" And then we get a volunteer. "You soldier." And I'd go, "Okay, I guess we're here to entertain the troops." And then they'd read the script again, and the soldier would kiss her. And a real, you know, we wrote in the script, they kiss a long, deep kiss. And, God, the guys went nuts. What I loved about this was as if each guy had kissed her. And then after the kiss, I go, wait, it's not over. There's another line. And Kerry said, there is? I said, go ahead, read it to the soldier. And the soldier would read, you know, Harriet, a woman your age really should have a thorough breast examination every year. Lucky for you, Dr. Al Franken is here. And then Kerry, and then I'd approach her with my hands out. She'd go, Al, at ease. And I'd say, too late for that now. And she'd go, get out of here. You know, so that was sort of the Bob Hope thing of getting a guy on stage to kiss a pretty girl. And we had cheerleaders. Remember I told you about the last time I did a USO tour of doing the Taliban cheerleaders and they asked
right.
me not to do it?
Yeah, you wanted to put them
in burkas.
And the State Department, was it, said that would be insulting to people in Afghanistan. Yeah.
This was October of 2001, late October 2001. And it was a general from, you know, the 3rd Air Wing or whatever in Europe who said, Mr. Franken, we understand you have ordered 3 burkas. I said, yeah, I didn't explain anything. Yes, we're not going to tell you how to do your job, but this is a war against terrorism, not against Islam. We're trying to send that message, and we prefer that you know. Yeah, so I didn't do it then. Now they were fine, so I did this. So we got 3 tearaway burkas. And the cheerleaders from Washington Redskins. So I'd bring them out and go, ladies and gentlemen, we, you know, no USO show is complete without cheerleaders. Unfortunately, the Washington Redskins cheerleaders missed their plane, and we're able to get a squad from in theater. And please welcome all the way from Kabul the Taliban cheerleaders. And the 3 came out in burkas. And I'd say, ladies, would you do a number, please? And the leader would whisper in my ear. And I said, you're not allowed to dance. You're not even allowed to listen to music. And she'd shake her head. And I'd say, well, wait a minute. We liberated you from the Taliban. What do you say, guys? Don't you want to hear a number? And they'd cheer. And then the girls would huddle and then come back to me. And I'd say, well, they're going to do a number. And then I'd go hit it. And it'd be, everybody dance now. And then that's my Gonna Make You Sweat by seeing music comedy. And they do this dance, and it was great. And then they were tearaway burkas, so they'd be in their uniforms. And the guys like seeing the cheerleaders more than even me.
That's amazing.
Isn't it? Considering my
speaking of you, most of the soldiers are probably too young to know you from Saturday Night Live. So,
that's not, well, except that
the
they repeat
reruns.
Saturday Night Live. Yeah.
Reruns, right.
So actually more know me from that than I think from my satire, although a lot of them knew me from the satire. And I actually was signing my book, which I thought was kind of odd there. But I had guys come up to me, which was actually almost even more gratifying, saying, I don't agree with you politically, but I really appreciate your coming. And then I'd say, it's my honor. And they go, no, it's my honor. And then I go, no, it's my honor. And then that was a lot of my chats with these guys.
My guest is Al Franken. He did an 8-day USO tour in December, entertaining the troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. His latest book is the bestseller Lies and the Lying Liars Who Tell Them. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Al Franken, and he got back Christmas Eve from an 8-day USO tour, which took him to Iraq, Afghanistan, and Uzbekistan. You know, hearing you do some of the material from the USO show that you did, it's so funny. Don't you wish that it was televised the way the old Bob Hope USO tours used to be?
This could have been this was a real classic, and it was partly because I had Andy along, and I had thought about this well beforehand. It was a very sort of classic variety show, and it could have been televised. And I think, you know, Saddam had just been captured the day before we left, And so I did a Saddam piece that was actually a very sort of Mighty Carson Art Players.
Mm-hmm.
You want me to do a little bit
please,
from that?
Oh, please, yeah.
Okay, I'll do a little bit from that. So Carrie, we go, ladies and gentlemen, we didn't want to announce our next guest ahead of time for reasons you'll understand. He's a very special, very secret surprise, former Iraqi president Saddam Hussein. Then I'd have two MPs lead me up in handcuffs. And I was in full Saddam uniform that I had gotten from Saturday Night, borrowed from Saturday Night Live with a mustache and everything. And I go, thank you, thank you. If they allowed me, Kerry, to carry an AK-47, I'd be firing it straight into the air right now. That's how happy I am to be here. Kerry, before you say anything, I've been thinking about it, and I've decided to let the inspectors back in. She'd say, well, I think it's kind of too late for that, Saddam. Oh, I was afraid you would say that. Well, we've been looking for you, Saddam. Where have you been the last 8 months? Well, you know, basically in the Tikrit area, visiting family, friends, socializing. Well, Saddam, we captured you in a tiny hole. Oh, yes, that's true. I've been spending a lot of time in holes. I have many holes around the country. Actually, the hole you found me in, that's one of my favorite holes. It's my winter hole. Your winter hole. Oh, yes, Kerry, you should see it. It had everything. It had the air duct. I could roll over. The dirt was very nicely packed. As you know, Kerry, I used to have 20, 30 palaces, but you know, the kids had grown. You want to downsize. So, the holes. Well, I see. Anyway, I have to say, you're looking a lot better than when we first found you. Yes, you know, any mass murder on the run, Kerry, sooner or later ends up looking a lot like Ted Kaczynski. But I've had a shave, a haircut, I've been deloused, I'm feeling great. Well, you're looking great. Well, thank you. I tell you what, Kerry, I like you so much, I'm willing to make you a deal. Here it is, one time only. I give you the weapons, you leave Iraq, in exchange you and return me to power, and I can resume killing and torturing anyone I want. Take it or leave it. I don't know, what do you say, guys? And the guys would go, boo, no, no. And then she'd say, Saddam Hussein, everybody, and then they'd boo. As I left, and then I would yell at them. So as you can see, it has nothing to do with sort of the normal biting, nuanced satire that I do here.
That's really funny. Now tell me this. You know, you're on stage with like cheerleaders, and you're doing a lot of sex jokes because it's soldiers who are starved for this. Do you end up doing material that outside of a military context might seem kind of like sexist to you, and you wouldn't think of going there because it would seem so kind of like old fashioned and?
Well, I think, for example, some of the material that I've just done for you, I would never do on NPR.
I won't let you know.
That would be suicide.
That's right. I'd never.
No, it's just a different kind of humor. But, you know, the women there, I mean, one out of six, I'd say, of the troops are women.
True,
and
right.
And they're just, I mean, right. it's a bawdy atmosphere. I mean, these are young people in their 20s. We went to Tikrit at one point. They divided us up. We were supposed to do two shows in Baghdad, but the first night, there was something going on in Baghdad. We couldn't do the show there. So they flew to Baghdad, then took a Black Hawk to three different locations, six different Black Hawks. But we went to Tikrit, and it was deemed the most dangerous place we could go. So we divided this up, and I said I would go to Tikrit if they would take me to the hole.
The Saddam Hussein hole.
I want to go to the Saddam Hussein
hole. This is so you could get into character for the sketch.
No, it was so that I could get a Christmas card for next year. I wanted... I wanted a picture of me in the hole with the two cheerleaders, with the Washington Redskins cheerleaders. And they said when I volunteered to go to Tikrit, and a lot of us actually went to Tikrit. Carrie went there and the Army band and the cheerleaders. So so I said, I will go to Tikrit if I can go to the hole. And then Andy went, and my brother went. My brother was
photographer
for... My brother, yes, he was the, my brother is a very, very, very good photographer who's done Newsweek covers, and he's a photojournalist and Time covers, and so this was a chance for us to spend 8 days together.
Mm-hmm.
So he came along, and so we were all really, 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 and Andy wanted to go to the hole. And they kept saying, yeah, we'll try to get you to the hole. And then we'd arrive into Crete, and they'd say, we have heard nothing about you wanting to go to the hole. And I ran into a guy who, speaking of the State Department, who was from Coalition Provisional Authority, who was fairly high up, who said, I'll get you to the hole. And then ultimately Hickey, the guy, the commander there, nixed it, which makes a lot of sense. I mean, the only reason we wanted to go to the hole for a lark, and we're in a war.
Right.
It would have involved a convoy taking us to the hole. So there was absolutely no reason.
But absolutely worth it for your Christmas card.
Yeah.
Right.
So, you know.
Well, listen, you know, you're in a really dangerous territory.
Yeah.
What were the risks like for you to do the USO tour?
Well, I have to say that I was never as afraid on the tour as I was before I left.
Mm-hmm.
Before I left, I did a lot of saying goodbye to my, you know, unnecessarily mawkish, maudlin goodbyes to my kids. Because I was actually genuinely believing that there was a chance I could get killed. And I guess the most danger we were in was landing in Baghdad, which we took incredibly steep and odd circular, very tight circle and very tight steep landing. Then taking off in the Black Hawk from Baghdad, and then you fly really low and really fast in these Black Hawks. And the reason you fly low is so that any of these guys with these shoulder-launched grenades or those kind of things can't get a bead on you. And in the Black Hawk, you're constantly doing, like, evasive swerving, and then every once in a while they approach a power line and just jump up, like, 100 feet, and then jump down. And a member of the Army band threw up. I was proud I didn't. And then landing into Crete was supposedly dangerous. And that was, you know, and then when we landed in the Baghdad air, on the airport, there was a lot of always like, where do we put our personal stuff? Where's our other stuff? And they go, get off the tarmac, get off the tarmac. And we had helmets and flak jackets and stuff like that. And then evidently leaving Bagram in a cargo plane, we may have been shot at. And they set off flares, which are a defensive mechanism to make missiles follow the flares instead of the plane. But that might have been just being more safe than sorry.
Al Franken will be back in the second half of the show. Here's his co-star on the USO tour, Daryl Worley. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
I hear people say we don't need this war, but I say there's some things worth fighting for. What about our freedom and this piece of ground? We didn't get to keep them by backing down.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Books, publishers of Carrie Scheider's American Yoga, The Paths and Practices of America's Greatest Yoga Masters, available at Barnes & Noble bookstores and online at bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Al Franken about his USO tour performing for the troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. And we talk with actor Benicio del Toro. He won an Oscar for his performance as a Mexican cop in Traffic. He's starring in the new film 21 Grams.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with satirist Al Franken. On Christmas Eve, he returned home from an eight-day USO tour, performing for the troops in Iraq, Afghanistan, Kuwait, and Uzbekistan. It was his fourth USO tour in 5 years. Franken's latest book is Lies and the Lying Liars Who Tell Them, A Fair and Balanced Look at the Right. Were there any moments on the tour that struck you as, like, particularly surreal?
Well, yeah, there was one where we flew from Tikrit in the Black Hawk to back to Baghdad. As we were getting on the helicopter, we noticed they were loading these tin containers of stuff, and it was Saddam's money that they had found somewhere. It was like $1.4 million in cash. And so they put that on our helicopter. And evidently, delivering that cash was more important than delivering us, because when we got to the Baghdad airport, they went right to the place where they were supposed to deposit the cash and dropped us off in this is a big airport. We didn't know where we were. So we just got off and wandered around, and we were cut off from our group, and we kind of walked into a bombed-out terminal where there were some infantry guys. So these are the guys that go out and are in danger all the time. And I remember running into a guy named Muncie. This is sort of our Apocalypse Now moment. So I run into a guy named, you know, and they've made these makeshift hooches in the terminal. And I run into this guy named, talk to this guy named Muncie, who's from Long Island. And he has kind of a real, you know, battle-worn look to him, and young guy, and tells me a couple weird things he's seen, a guy in his unit who killed himself. And anyway, so we just have this time to kill. There's nothing to do. So we did a show. We did for like 12 soldiers. We did a few. We did the Saddam piece.
Well, that's great.
And the cheerleaders did, you know, some stuff. So, yeah, and it was, and then somehow we were found. But that was sort of the most surreal thing, and you know.
So you were on the plane with the money?
It was on the helicopter with the money, and I tried to make.
Didn't that make you feel a little bit like a target?
I don't think anyone knew there was money there except for us.
Oh.
We also actually, this is where a guy threw up, and so we dropped. I thought we stopped halfway in between. I didn't know why we were dropping, but it turned out that we were dropping off a chaplain, because a guy at a small base had died, and we also emptied the helmet of the guy who threw up, and. But no, I don't think anyone knew we had this money. I tried to, as a joke, steal the money. And it was very heavy, the tins they put it in, I think deliberately. So I couldn't steal the, there were three tins, each with about $500,000 in it. And
next
I tried
time.
To make off
next
with
time.
One.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and I couldn't break into the tins either. So I don't know. I think it was American, you know, it was dollars. And it was just a drop in Saddam's bucket.
If you're just joining us, my guest is satirist Al Franken, and he just did an eight-day tour, USO tour, in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Uzbekistan. Now, you spent a night of Hanukkah celebrating the holiday in one of Saddam's palaces. What exactly was the Hanukkah celebration in the palace like?
Well, it was in this huge palace. He has I mean, if you fly over this country, by the way, it's a very pretty country. And north of Baghdad, anyway, which I was flying over in a helicopter, so it was easier to see, it gets green, it gets their wetlands. Tikrit is a beautiful city. I think it's his hometown, so he dropped a lot of cash in it. And, you know, it's obscene. These palaces are obscene. The size and scope and the amount of marble and just the egotism of the guy. I mean, there are these, the one in Baghdad, every pillar, these huge marble pillars, had his initials carved in them in a huge way and inlaid with gold. And so we were in this, the main foyer of this palace with the hugest cut glass chandelier, just unfathomably big. And there wasn't much furniture. The I don't know if it was looting or if whether the military's just taking the furniture out. But we did have this, there was this huge like samovar or coffee maker that we put the menorah on and some ornate chair. And we just did the, you know, we did the prayer for lighting the candles. And we did it both, it was both solemn and both a big giant F you to the guy.
Mm-hmm.
Who wasn't very far away. We were in this, near the Baghdad airport, and that's where he's being kept. And it was kind of cool. It was kind of moving. You know, he has at one of his palaces or one of his command centers this giant mural of Scuds being sent to Israel and destroying Israel.
Okay.
So that's like, you know, so it was me and my brother and Steve and Andy Breckman, you know, singing the prayer. And part of the leitmotif of the tour was we were two country singers and their guitarists and their road managers and their, and there was a wrestler named Bradshaw, who's a very well-known wrestler who is a big redneck, a self-proclaimed redneck. So there was a redneck versus Jew leitmotif to the whole tour, which was just a tremendous amount of giving each other crap. And Daryl was with us when we did Hanukkah, and he was unbelievably moved. And it was just, you know, it was cool.
You got back to New York on Christmas Eve. What was it like coming home on Christmas Eve, having successfully completed this experience that you were really worrying about because you thought that it was possible you'd get killed?
Well, I was obviously very happy to see my family, although I found that after eight days in a war zone, I could no longer relate to them. They had not seen the horrors I had seen. No, it was, that's not true.
You're having flashbacks
mainly,
now?
I don't know, I was over-dramatizing my 8 days. We had a very nice Christmas dinner, and I slept an incredible amount. Because we were humping it the whole time. There were nights where we had like two and a half hours of sleep, and we were just doing a lot of sleeping in planes and traveling in very cramped cargo planes. And so when I got home, at one point I laid on the couch, my son put my black lab Kirby on top of me, and I just lay, and just Kirby and I just slept together for about 4 hours. So there was a lot of that. There was a lot of just me being tired, and we haven't seen you in 8 days, Dad, and you're just tired.
Al Franken, really a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
As always.
Al Franken did an 8-day USO tour in December. His latest book is the bestseller Lies and the Lying Liars Who Tell Them. Coming up, actor Benicio del Toro. He's starring in the new film 21 Grams. This is Fresh Air. It was hard to tell what Benicio del Toro was saying when he co-starred in the film The Usual Suspects. That weird, mumbly speaking style he created helped make him famous. He won an Oscar for his supporting role as a Mexican cop in the film Traffic. Now he's starring with Sean Penn in the film 21 Grams. The title refers to what some say is the weight we lose when we die. Each character in the movie is facing death, their own or someone else's. The story is told out of chronological sequence, moving back and forth in time, so it takes a while before we understand what each character is facing and how the lives of the characters intersect. So I won't give too much away here. Del Toro plays an ex-con who has returned home to his wife and two children and has turned to Jesus Christ to help him keep on the straight and narrow. Most of the people in his church seem down and out. Early in the film, he tries to straighten out a troubled kid who belongs to his church.
They didn't lock you up this time because you're not 18 yet. Next time, they're going to lock you up, brother. Come on. You're not thinking. Still, I might get you money. You can tap some cheerleader's ass. Show off riding some pickle-colored Thunderbird. But tell me, what's going to happen if you shoot a pregnant woman or an old man, huh? You know what'll happen? The guilt will suck you down to the bone. Stealing ain't worth it. Going to church, reading the Bible, and believing in Jesus, brother, that's your ticket.
Did playing this role make you think more about religion?
Yeah. I reread Job from the Bible. I reread maybe some sections of the Bible that I quote in the movie. And it made me think about religion, and I think about religion quite a bit. I mean, I was raised Catholic, and I believe in God. You know, I don't know if I believe it like the Catholic church with the rituals and all this stuff that you have to do, but I do believe in God. I believe in something bigger than you or me. But it was clear that the problem that I was having with the character was not the problem of religion, was a problem of the human being. You know, it's a problem of...
And the problem of his expectations of what religion could do for him
the lack of knowledge of what really is happening to him. What really is happening to him is a depression. It's a thing called survival guilt. And I'll give you another example, which is basically what's happening to him. But he doesn't understand this. He's not capable of doing it. So he turns to religion for that help, that, you know, that give me the answer right now. I need it right now. I'm suffering. But what really is going on is a depression.
Now, in 21 Grams and in Traffic, you play very emotionally complex characters. In the first movie that many of us noticed you in, The Usual Suspects, if your character is emotionally complex, we wouldn't know it. Do you know what I mean? We just see a little bit of him, and we don't really know his past. I mean, he's kind of opaque in that sense. Really stood out in viewers' minds was the accent, that strange mumble that you use in the movie. And I'm wondering if you came up with that in part because there wasn't much of a character written in to the part.
Well, when I read the script, The Usual Suspects, the script was written by Christopher McQuarrie, and I read it and... I read my character. The purpose of my character was the first one to die. There was nothing else. He didn't add anything to the plot. He didn't. You know, there was the only purpose was this is the first one that falls, and then everybody starts to get afraid of Kaiser Soze. So, I went up to the director and said, might as well let me run with this. And honestly, I was very afraid. I didn't know if it worked at all. And when I finished shooting the film, I felt like I turned into a clown. But it did work out. We got to thank the editor.
Why don't we hear just an excerpt of a scene from The Usual Suspects with you using that wonderful mumble.
I really, 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 somebody do something about this. I ain't gonna hold it every 5 minutes. So I did a little time. Does that mean I get railed every time a truck finds whatever to find?
Finster, will you relax? These guys don't have any probable cause.
You're f***ing right. No PC, no goddamn right. You do some time, never let you go. You know, it treat me like a criminal. I end up a criminal.
You are a criminal.
And what you gotta go and do that? Trying to make a point.
Well, why don't you make your point? You're making me tired all over.
That's Benicio del Toro in The Usual Suspects. Can you talk a little bit about how you developed that particular sound, that mumble?
I think I was watching Dustin Hoffman and Dick Tracy. And he did a character called Mumbles. So I took it from, I said, well, I'm going to do my own interpretation of Mumbles. We'll see other actors do the mumble. But I'm not the first, and it won't be the last.
When I saw The Usual Suspects, I wasn't really sure whether that was the way you talked or that was just the way your character talked. So I waited for your next movie to see, you know, is that really his voice? And am I alone in having had that initial reaction? Did any casting directors have that same that same doubt?
I don't know exactly about that. I don't know, because I've been running around L.A. doing auditions for years before the usual suspect.
So people knew you already.
Well, the casting directors knew me a little bit.
Right.
Some better than others. But I do remember going up to I think it's 7-Eleven and trying the voice and ordering something. From the guy on the at the counter, and I remember his look was like, immediately he saw, there was this look of fear of some kind of like I was gonna rob the place or something like that, and I remember thinking, boy, that works, and I'm gonna try and do it.
Are you patient when it comes time to learn your lines and repeat them over and over until they're really natural?
I'm really bad at learning my lines. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think we should let everybody know, but I study with Stella Adler,
mm-hmm.
and Stella Adler's approach to acting was always, you know, go to the lines last. Don't go to the lines before you understand what the character is, who the character is, what the character wants. And once you understand that, then go to the lines. So I believe in that. I mean, if I was doing theater, then I would know the lines by opening night, because you go through a rehearsal process. But when it comes to movies, you don't have a rehearsal process. So sometimes I might find myself, catch myself the night before learning the lines like a maniac. But to me, the lines are important, but it's the last thing that I go to.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I really believe that if I understand what the character wants and what the scene is about, the lines will come to me. And it does happen. You know, the lines, it's easier to learn the lines once you understand it. But sometimes, you know, people go straight to the lines before they understand what the character is doing. And what happens is that you're just saying lines.
So why don't actors rehearse in films? Is it money? Is it just that it's too expensive?
I think that I think actors in movies are sprinters, you know. And I think that...
one scene at a time?
Well, you're a sprinter. You go really fast. Once the movie, it's a lot of money to make a movie, you know. So once they have the money, and you don't know when a movie's going to get the money. Mm-hmm. You don't know. You have that day to do it. You won't come back the next day and do the get a second chance to do it. Like they say, like, oh, well, in movies, you get another take. Yeah, I get another take that day. But the next day, I don't get another take on the scene that I did yesterday. As an actor on theater, I do the play today, but I come back tomorrow and I get a second chance to do the whole play.
Right. I see your point.
You know?
Yeah.
And, you know, so as an actor in movies, you have that day and that's it.
My guest is Benicio del Toro. He's starring in the new film, 21 Grams. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We'll be right back. My guest is Benicio del Toro. He co-starred in The Usual Suspects, won an Oscar for his performance in Traffic, and is now starring with Sean Penn in the film 21 Grams. You grew up in Puerto Rico and moved to Pennsylvania, I believe, when you were 10. Is that right?
No, 13.
Oh, 13. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. What was the occasion for moving?
I was sent to school.
To boarding school?
Yeah.
Did it make you feel independent or lonely to be away from home?
Both.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it did. Loneliness is good, you know. You know, maybe being alone is good, not loneliness. So I think it's more like it made me feel independent and alone. And being alone, I think it was very healthy for me. Because it gave me a chance to think, daydream, you know, to really look at myself and kind of like, I found myself, you know, in Puerto Rico, I had like many friends and I was never alone. And when I found myself alone in Pennsylvania, I just gave me a chance to like, to look at what, who I was and think. And I think it was very healthy, and I still like, you know, every now and then I need to be alone.
Now, I understand you have a big book and record collection. Now, I've read that you sometimes use records to help you find a character you're going to portray and get into the character. How do you use music like that?
I don't know if I use it to find a character, but I do use it to somehow, I think, to relax. I think music is it's kind of like a pacifier of some sort. I don't know, for me, and I'm sure for a lot of people, music is very powerful. And like, let's take a movie like 21 Grams.
Mm-hmm.
It's really intense. So it's like, I've been asked, you know, how did you take this character to your hotel after work? And I said, well, you know, I make sure I leave it, you know, on the set, leave the character on the set. And the only way to do that is like by, you know, for me, it was listening to music, you know, just kind of like, and, you know, I'm very specific about what I was listening to. I was shooting in Memphis, Tennessee. So I went to see Sun Records. And rediscovered Elvis Presley's 1955-56 Sun Record album, which is like the recordings he did in Sun Record from 1955 to 1956, before he signed with RCA, and I listened to that a lot while I was doing the movie. And I really had a fun time listening to it in the car driving to the set. I don't know, it's just like, it made it easier for me to get in that car to go and work on this character, which is pretty dark, so it did help me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, getting in the car and you know, blasting a song like, your light, you're right, I'm left, she's gone. Or I forgot to remember to forget. Shake, rattle, and roll. You know, it's just like, I don't know, it just made it easier to drive to the set.
Well, I understand one of the movies you'd like to make is a biography of Che Guevara. Why would you like to do that?
Why would I like to do that?
What's Che Guevara's importance to
Well,
you?
I think that Che Guevara has been completely misunderstood, you know. And I'll give you an example. The fact that the other day I was watching TV, and I was watching the Discovery Channel, which I like very much, and they had a two-part series on terrorism. And as they're putting some images of September 11th and other things, and the FBI, the Oklahoma bombing, bang, they have an image of Che Guevara in the middle of all this, right next to Osama bin Laden. And you know, if they knew anything about the guy, if they read anything about what the guy said, you know, he really was against terrorism. He does look like a, you know, that picture of him with the beard is a pretty intense picture. And it's easy to use that picture and go like, hey, terrorist. But, you know, he wrote. He was a thinker. He was a father of five, you know, and he had his ideas, and he felt for the little people in some ways, and he felt like, you know, something had to be done, and he was a warrior.
Benicio del Toro is starring in the film 21 Grams. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
And I'm left all alone. Well, you tried to tell me so, but honey, I know that she was not the one for me, not the one. You know you told me, well, you told me all alone, all alone. You're so right, our love was so wrong, love was wrong. Was the day she said goodbye, you know I didn't. No, I didn't even cry. All I knew, I would then turn to you, sweet little you. Well, I thought I knew just what you do. Guess I'm not so smart. Boy, you tried to tell me all along.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, inequities in the tax system. Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter David K. Johnston says the system makes it easy for the super rich and big corporations to dodge taxes, and that passes on the tax burden to everybody else. Johnston's new book is called Perfectly Legal. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.